I'm going to continue with the thoughts we had started with this morning. If you'd like to turn to Genesis chapter 12. Now, as Stephen is recounting the history of the people of Israel up to his own time, he mentions in Acts 7, 2 through 4 that the glory of God came to them. And we don't have much of a description of how God came to Abram in Genesis chapter 12, where the first verse picks up after the Tower of Babel incident, and just the Lord said to Abraham. But if you look at verse 7, it says that then the Lord appeared to Abram. The Lord appeared. So whatever Abram was dealing with, he could actually see someone that he was conversing with. Now, we don't actually know if this is true, but it was believed that if any human saw God, Jehovah, in his natural aspect, then he would die. At least that was the belief of Samson's parents and Gideon, etc. That was the prevalent belief. So whatever, if that's true, then whatever the case is, we do have an appearance. Whoever Abram was talking to and conversing with was actually something that he could see. And it wasn't a vision either, because it doesn't say that the Lord came to him in a vision. So if we go back to 15, where God actually makes the covenant with Abraham, we get a little bit more detail. After these things, it says, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. So this is, we don't know the exact circumstances in chapter 12, but we do have it here that it is in a vision. But notice what it says. It says, the word of the Lord came. The word of the Lord came. The word of the Lord is a person. And it said, saying, do not be afraid, Abram, I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. So this is, we notice right from the start that this word of Jehovah who comes to Abraham in a vision, as before, the encounter was a visible manifestation, albeit in a vision. And the word here is something that can be seen. In verse 4, we read, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. So these aren't a bunch of Hebrew consonants floating in the air in front of Abram. This is a person. It has to be. The context and grammar indicates that this is an actual entity that was known as the word of the Lord or the word of Jehovah. And throughout the Old Testament, we see this same thing. The prophet Jeremiah, it says, the word of the Lord came to me. And then later it says, the word of the Lord touched me. So words on a chalkboard and whatnot don't reach out and touch people, but this entity called the word of the Lord does. Now, John, the apostle, picked up on this concept in his writings. The word logos, the Greek word logos that we come to in the Gospel of John and also in 1 John, he wasn't making that up, and he certainly was, I hate reading this in commentaries, he wasn't drawing on Greek thought or philosophy. He was drawing on the Old Testament writing in a different language than the Old Testament primarily used. So the word in the Old Testament becomes logos in the Greek New Testament. But the concept is the exact same. It's very clear in these passages that when you're conversing with the word of the Lord, whether it's Abram here or whether it's the prophet Jeremiah hundreds of years later, the word of the Lord is you're talking to God. Without a doubt. So in John chapter 1, he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That was completely and 100% true. It may be true that if a man saw God in his natural state and form, he would die. We don't have that from God's mouth or a prophet's mouth, but that is what was commonly believed. If that is true, then what God did was send, I believe, the Word, who would eventually take on flesh and become Jesus, so that he could converse with people and deal with people. And we see this conceptually throughout a lot of the Old Testament. In Galatians 3:8, Paul says that the gospel, that through the gospel, God would justify the Gentile nations. And he says that that gospel was preached to Abraham. By who? It has to be these meetings with this word of the Lord. And it preached to him that through him all nations would be blessed. This was the beginning of the gospel, and it's a clear reference to the content of the covenant that was made with Abraham. In 1 Samuel 3:10, Samuel keeps hearing a voice calling his name while he's trying to sleep, and he assumes it's the voice of the priest Eli and goes to the elderly man, but it was not Eli who spoke. After hearing the voice the third time, Eli realizes that it's Jehovah who is calling and instructs Samuel how he should respond. So when Samuel goes back to bed, the narrative continues in verse 10, "Then Jehovah came and stood there and called out as before." So we have an appearance of Jehovah in some way or form. Otherwise, it wouldn't say that he was standing there. Now, there's no indication in the callings before that Jehovah was standing there. But in verse 10 of 1 Samuel 3, it does say that Jehovah indeed was standing there. And then later it says, "And Samuel grew up, and Jehovah was with him. He did not allow any of his prophecies to go unfulfilled. All Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, realized that Samuel was faithful as a prophet to Jehovah, and Jehovah appeared again in Shiloh." And then it says something very interesting. So it's obvious that God is with Shiloh because he's appearing with him. Then it says, "And Jehovah appeared again in Shiloh, for Jehovah revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh through the word of the Lord." So the Lord's appearance, and this is, the word means specifically something that can be seen. His appearance was in the guise or in the form of this entity known as the word of the Lord. In Genesis 18 earlier, we have Abraham at the oak. And this is the instance where Jehovah and the angels come and he washes their feet. Abraham knows who this is because he's met him before. He knows exactly who it is, and he in fact addresses him as the Lord, the judge of all the earth. So he doesn't think this is just some rich guy that's come to pay him a visit. He knows exactly who this is from the very beginning. Gideon had a similar instance where he met the angel of the Lord, but he wasn't sure who it was. Why? Because he had never dealt with him before. That was his introduction to the angel of the Lord. So this angel of the Lord appears beginning in Genesis 22, where Abraham sacrificed his covenant son Isaac. And there's something of an interesting story that takes place here. And this is obviously a important, almost a transformational moment for Abraham, because it's at this point that God realizes that he's not going to withhold anything from him. And in verse 10 says, "And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son." So he was actually in the process of doing it. It says, "But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, 'Abraham, Abraham.' So he said, 'Here I am.'" Verse 12, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." If we jump forward in time to God describing this angel to the Israelites in Exodus chapter 23, he says in verse 20, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared." So this is the angel of the presence discussed in Isaiah 63. And then God says something interesting, 21, "Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries, for my angel will go before you and bring you in to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off." Just as when he says, I will speak with his voice, he says, this angel will go before you and I will cut off your enemies. So this angel was visibly present with them. Now you'll recall, God promised the Israelites that my terror would what? Would go before you. The angel of the Lord is the terror. It was the angel of the Lord that was shepherding them and guiding them this entire time And he warns them to heed his voice because this angel and God speak with the same voice. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. We know that this angel, wherever he was holy ground. This was the angel that was in the midst of the burning bush, it says in Exodus chapter 3. And, of course, Moses had to remove his feet, or remove the sandals from his feet because the ground indeed was holy. All right, is there any questions or comments up to this point? All right. It's pretty clear in passages dealing with the angel of Jehovah that he is the divine presence of God. And the fact that God points out the fact that my name is in him, there's no other angel in the Bible that has God's name. And that's a big deal because naming is a huge convention in the Bible. You'll remember when God set up the creation, what did he do with the animals on day one? He brought them before Adam so Adam could what? Name them. Why did it matter what Adam was going to name them? Because God had given Adam dominion over the earth. And when you name something, you kind of take ownership of it. Your first prerogative as a parent is to bestow a name to your child, and they're going to be stuck with it forever, whether they like it or not. But that is your prerogative as a parent. So when you name something, you take over ownership of it. That's why in Daniel chapter 1, it's a really big deal when those young men are taken from their home country to Babylon. What's the first thing they receive when they get there? A new name. Because the point of that was to try to turn them into Babylonians. Our names are such an important part of our identity. You think about how important. I think of myself as Kyle, and I can't think of myself as anybody else. I imagine I'm always going to feel that way. I'm essentially going to always think of myself as Kyle. So here we have this angel who has Jehovah's own name in him. This has to be a manifestation of Jehovah himself in a visible form that could be interacted with. And this angel wasn't doing just nothing. He was actually leading and guiding and conquering armies. And we see him also in the book of Joshua and Judges, where he morphs into the commander of the Lord's army because he's taking on a new role. He had been the shepherd while they were in their sojourns, which we have Christ as our shepherd now. But then he's going to enter Canaan in judgment, leading the armies of Israel against those seven nations, both greater, all greater than the Israelites in number. And he was going to judge those nations because the cup of the Amorites' iniquity was finally full. So God, Christ was going to lead the armies into Israel and punish those nations. And so he took on a new mantle, that of a commander. And God told them in Exodus 23, if you heed his voice, if you obey him, if you do not transgress, because it's interesting, he says he won't pardon your transgressions. That's because that's not what his role was in that one passage. But then when we get to Judges chapter 2, you have to keep in mind that this angel's been with them this whole time. It says, then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. Isn't that interesting? So here's this angel taking all these prerogatives of God. And said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was, when the angel of the Lord spoke these things to all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Then they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. So they wept, because as long as this guy was fighting with them, they were unbeatable in combat. You get the idea that so long as they were doing what they were supposed to do, the Israelites conquered relatively easy. In fact, they only lost a handful of men against the southern Amalekites when they realized that the Lord was not with them. That's because when the Lord was with them, the Lord was doing their fighting for them, probably in some supernatural form, and it made it easy. The conquest was relatively easy for them. All that had to be done was persevere with it and stick to this angel. But this angel says that you broke my covenant. And therefore, these inhabitants and their gods are going to become a snare for you. And that's exactly the way it happens. So the most familiar way to process what we've seen in all these instances with the word of the Lord and the angel of the Lord is to think about the way that we talk about Jesus. And when we see the name of the Lord, the word of the Lord, the angel of the Lord, the commander of the Lord's armies, etc., etc., you can take those things that are said about these entities and apply them directly to Jesus, and it's a one-to-one correspondence because there's a lot of foreshadowing in the Bible. And through these manifestations, I believe that the angel, the word, the name, etc., is showing what he's going to be doing for us spiritually. Christians affirm that God is more than one person. We commonly talk about this as the three in one or the Trinity. Phrases that don't appear in the Bible, but the concept does. So he is the three in one, but each of those persons is, although distinct in some ways, is the same in essence. They have the same will. They have the same voice. They have the same thoughts and the same purposes. They're completely unified in their goals and aspirations. We affirm that Jesus Christ is one of those persons, that he is God, but he is not the Father. This is where it starts getting a little weird, but even 1 Corinthians 15 says that the kingdom will be restored to God the Father. We've been exposed to most of these theologies in the Old Testament. In fact, all of them have their roots there. And it is quite clear in the Old Testament that there are two Jehovah figures in the Old Testament. And sometimes, as in the story of Gideon, they even interact with one another and other individuals in the scenes in which they appear. But at the same time, those instances conflate the two identities. And I would submit that the conflation of those two identities or the merging of those two individuals is on purpose because they essentially are the same entities. These two Jehovah figures are a part of Old Testament thought. And in fact, the Jews wrote about what they called the two powers in heaven theology. And the reason they killed this theology in the second century AD is because you remember that it was possible for the apostles to prove from the scriptures that Christ, that the Lord was Christ, that Jesus was the Messiah. It does seem that after that time, the Jews made a point of obscuring their texts, and some of these texts would eventually become the Masoretic text, of obscuring a lot of the passages that make it clear there were two Jehovahs just for the purpose of obscuring this Jesus of Nazareth, whom the Christian sect was saying was the Son of God. But in the Old Testament, it's pretty clear that there were two Jehovahs, one invisible and the other visible, that could even take on a human form. Judaism, before the first century, the time of Jesus, knew this teaching, and that's why ancient Jewish theology once embraced two Jehovah figures. But this once teaching came to involve the risen Jesus of Nazareth. Judaism could no longer tolerate it, and a lot of our texts that come to us in the Old Testament have obscured some of these traces that are actually easier to read in the original text. In English, coming through several translations and a whole bunch of centuries, sometimes the meaning gets lost and it's easy to lose. But one of the main points is that the divinity of Jesus is telegraphed throughout the Old Testament. The very fact that the word Elohim is used to describe God, and it's a plural word, tells us something about the nature of this God. That while he is three, he is also one. I've already pointed out that the word of the Lord appears, and he even reaches out and touches prophets at times. So the word of the Lord in the Old Testament is an entity, and we see this as the Logos in John chapter 1 and 1 John 1. The angel of Jehovah, in Exodus 23, he said, "My name is in him." When Jesus was born, his parents called him Jesus, which is English from Greek, from Latin, from Aramaic, and then Hebrew, for Joshua. So his name was Joshua. Joshua means what? Actually, it means Jehovah is salvation. See what God did there? My name is in him. Jehovah is salvation. Even in Christ's name that he was given bears a resemblance to this angel of Jehovah, whose name was in God, and therefore that angel was God. Exodus 23:20, behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way. What does Jesus do? He keeps us in the way and brings you to a place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. We saw in Judges chapter 2 that they did not heed his voice, and so he left. On the Mount of Transfiguration, what did the voice from heaven say? The invisible speaker God said, this is my beloved Son, hear him. Hear him. So here we have this angel that God says, obey his voice. And then when he left, he said, it's because you didn't listen. And this is telegraphed in the New Testament when he says, this is my beloved Son. Hear him. In Isaiah chapter 63, he was called the angel of the presence. Now, if you read that closely, he was called the angel of the presence when he was with the children of Israel. So he's the angel of the presence not because he's from the presence of God, or not because he's in the presence of God, but because he is the presence of God. If the angel of Jehovah was with you, then God was with you. It's as simple as that. And what did Isaiah promise that this Savior would be called? He would be called Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Jesus is here to be our good shepherd. And shepherds do not abandon their flock. It's as simple as that. The sheep hear his voice and they follow him. I learned something interesting about shepherding not too long ago. A lot of times, so that they could get some sleep while they were shepherding, shepherds would band together and they would corral their sheep together. And those sheep had, those corrals had one entrance. And the shepherds would sleep in that entrance. Remember, what did Jesus say? I am the door. I am the door. So anything that was going to get to the sheep had to go through these shepherds. But over the course of the night, the sheep would mingle and intermix with one another. You might have 2 to 4 flocks all in one pen. Well, the shepherds the next morning when they decided to go back to work, they didn't sit there and as the sheep came out one by one, sort them, because that would take forever. That would take all day. All they did was each shepherd would walk in a different direction, and guess what they did? They called to their sheep, and the sheep knew their shepherd's voice. Abraham recognized the word and the angel to whom he spoke. So when the angel spoke to him, he knew it was the Lord of all, the judge of all the earth. And so he recognized his voice. Christ speaks to us through his word, and it is a voice that we recognize. We recognize its love and its care and its compassion. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. We understand that Christ understands us. We understand that Christ understands our needs and the way that we suffer being flesh. We hear his voice and we voluntarily follow it as God was asking the Israelites to do the same several thousand years ago. To hear his voice and follow along as he had given them instruction. Any questions or comments or thoughts or clarifications?
Ed. Comment on Isaiah 9:6.
You want to go ahead and read that for us?
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
What specifically?
Well, I just... If you look about how similar the Word and the Father are, who is he talking about? He's talking about the Savior.
Mm-hmm.
And his name, those are his names.
Yeah.
And I think that just shows from the beginning how God revealed that they truly are one. But I always wondered on the one thing. Everlasting Father.
Okay.
Have you done anything?
My only thought about that is to point out that he and his Father are one. And I don't know if there's a whole lot more to it than that.
In other words, they share the same Jehovah.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because in the same verse you have unto us a son is given, but then he's going to be also called Everlasting Father. There is a part of this, I think, also when from 1 Corinthians 15 where it says that the kingdom will be returned to the Father. And that's when Christ has already put an end to what? All rule, power, and authority. Of course, he's talking about authority outside of himself, but that's been my only thought there, is that all of these titles are aspects of his divinity and his purpose.
Saying as Joshua entered the promised land and he spoke with the commander of the Lord of hosts.
Yeah.
And he worshiped.
Right. Yeah, the same instance he had to remove his sandals and because the ground was also holy. Yeah, that's a good point. I forgot to mention that. Anything else? One of the reasons I started this study was I have been asked before, what was Christ up to before he became Jesus? Because a lot of people have the idea that he wasn't doing much of anything. And that can kind of lead to musings about whether Christ was actually a created being or not, which is actually where those speculations have gone at times. The purpose was to find out how God decided to work. And it seems, at least my conclusion is, that from near the beginning, at least when it required intercession and mediation, God chose to act through this individual who would become known to us as Jesus from a very early period. If you look at what Peter wrote, he mentioned that there was a spirit of Christ. There was Christ, or Christ talked to the spirits who are in prison. And he did this during the time before the flood. So we had these entities, these spirits, who were rebellious against God, and God sent Christ, who we would eventually know as Christ, God sent Christ to talk to him. Psalm 82 is another instance where God decided to use a council, other individuals, to execute judgment. He would do the same thing with Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4. God has always used others to perform to act according to his purpose, but there is something special about his son. As soon as Seth was born, you'll recall that Abel had already been murdered, but as soon as Seth was born, it says that he bore the likeness of who? People often forget this, but it says that he bore a son, Seth, according to his own likeness. He had a son, Seth, according to his own likeness. And Jesus, of course, is the Son of God, and he is the express image of the Father. That concept of being in the image of has to do with representation. Your children are your legacy to the world. When you're gone, it's likely that you, at least one of your children, maybe more than one, will be here after you. And whatever people think of you is eventually going to depend on what they think of who? Your children. So we have this kind of interesting scenario where God has set up a system where we all train up our children to go in a certain way, and in a real way, they represent us out in the world. And people will think so-and-so was a good father or mother, in large part based on how they see their children operating as young adults and as adults. But Jesus is so perfect that he's the express image of his Father, which means he's the perfect representation of his Father. And it's through him that we now can be called sons of God, just like he is. And there's a lot of theological things that can springboard off of a study like this. But one of them is that through Jesus, God was reconciling the world to himself and bringing us into his household. Now, a royal household has one king. But the thing about those royal families is that they're all still considered what? Royals. We still speak of Elizabeth as the queen of Egypt, but her family are all called the royal family. They all have the right to be called the royals. And so Jesus, through His work is bringing us back into a relationship with God that we had before. Otherwise, that word reconcile becomes meaningless. He's trying to get us back to the relationship that we had before. And that was as express images of His will and purpose. Only Jesus can put us back in that right relationship with God. All right, that's our thoughts for this afternoon. Is there any other questions or comments that you'd like to make before we close? All right, then we'll offer a quick invitation. If there's anything that the congregation can do for you to help you out or get you to draw closer or nearer to your God, then we invite you to come forward as we stand and as we sing.